morning. You may be seated. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. Today is Thursday, June 15th, 2023. We have three cases on our calendar today. Excuse me. Just my chair here. We have, for our first case today, is A23-0005, City of White Bear Lake, Relator versus Amy. Is it Krieghauser? Krieghauser. Okay, thank you. The Public Employees Retirement Association. Counsel for appellant, you will have 15 minutes for your initial arguments, followed by 15 minutes by respondent, and then 5 minutes for rebuttal, if you so choose. The podium in the middle there has a button just underneath, so you can raise and lower the podium to adjust. There is also the clock there, which indicates how much time you have, so make sure you are aware of that so you stay within the time limits. And with that, counsel, when you are ready, you may approach the podium. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Robert Alsop. I represent the City of White Bear Lake. I want to start by saying it's kind of nice to be back live before the Court of Appeals again. I'm here today to ask the court to reverse the findings of fact, conclusions of law, and order issued by Administrative Law Judge Stephen Bilek on December 14th, 2022. The ALJ affirmed the findings of the Public Employee Retirement Association, or PARA, that firefighter Amy Krieghauser sustained a duty disability as defined by Minnesota Statute 353.01, Subdivision 41, and that the City of White Bear Lake was responsible for continuing to provide health insurance coverage as her employer pursuant to Minnesota Statute 299A.465. The City contends that the ALJ's decision is based on an erroneous interpretation of the relevant statutes and inappropriately relies on facts that are contrary to the evidence offered at the hearing or irrelevant to interpreting the law. The legislature clearly does not intend for the City of White Bear Lake to be responsible for benefits paid to an employee who is injured while working for a different employer altogether.
And what statutory language do you point to support your assertion that the legislature clearly did not intend for what happened here to occur?
Well, the argument that we articulated in the brief, Your Honor, is that pursuant to the definition of duty disability, it references inherently dangerous duties relevant to a position covered by the police and fire retirement plan.
So, the statute doesn't define positions covered, but well, what do you assert positions covered by the Public Employees Police and Fire Retirement Plan refers to?
Our argument on this is that the position that's relevant is the position in which the injury occurred. And in this case, the injury occurred while Ms. Krieghauser was working for the City of Hugo. She was not working for the City of White Bear Lake.
What language specifically in that statute, subdivision 41, do you read that language, though?
Well, it refers to a position. So that has to refer to some position. What position are we talking about?
But it talks about the performance of inherently dangerous duties that are specific to the positions covered by the Public Employees Police and Fire Retirement Plan. So it's talking about the positions that are covered by that plan.
Right.
And that's what the ALJ analyzed in its order. It specifically broke down the elements of the duty disability, and it broke it down to five different elements and compared those to and then apply the particular facts here. How is the ALJ's analysis of that statute erroneous?
Again, I focus on the position, and the position that she was injured at in the time, at the time of the injury was a volunteer firefighter. And under the statute, volunteer firefighters are not included in the police and fire retirement plan. They're specifically excluded under 343.
But you're reading in language there that does not exist in the statute.
I'm actually giving meaning to the word position that is ignored by the ALJ and the respondent. You have to give some meaning to that term, position.
Right, but it talks about the positions that are that are covered by the plan.
Right, so
so you have to look at the plan, right, to see what are the inherently dangerous duties that are specific to the positions covered by that plan.
And volunteer firefighters are not covered by that plan.
So if I understand, what you're saying is that the positions covered by the public employees, police and fire retirement plan, vis-a-vis Ms. Kriegshauser, would be her position as a firefighter with White Bear Lake. But then I think your argument is the injury did not occur while she was in that covered
Correct.
Position. Okay.
I mean,
but that's not language that's in the statute, though. It seems like you're reading into the statute language that does not exist. It doesn't talk about, for whom the person is working.
Let's go a little bit before that. They are performing, arising out of the performance. They're performing something of inherently dangerous duties.
Right.
That are specific to the position covered by, she was not doing that. The performance that she was doing was a volunteer firefighter. She was not performing the duties, inherently dangerous duties, of a position covered by the plan.
What are the duties that are covered by White Bear Lake, firefighter, plan?
My problem with going down that road, Your Honor, is that you could identify those duties for any city in the state of Minnesota. I could bring in the job description for the city of Mankato and say that she was doing those duties. She doesn't qualify for Mankato. And I don't want to be glib about this, but there is testimony in the record from the incident commander on the site that she was performing the duties of the volunteer firefighter for the city of Hugo.
You're focusing on for whom the duties are being performed.
Correct.
I don't see that language in the statute at all.
So I guess my question is, anytime they perform inherently dangerous duties, they have to be tied to some position, right?
Right, and under the statute, that they're tied to the duties that are performed...
in a position.
With the plan.
And volunteer
covered by the employees' police and fire retirement plan.
She's not covered. The volunteer position is not covered by the plan.
But you're. I realize we're talking a little bit in circles, but it just seems like, if your argument was, if there was language in the statute that's referred to, for whom the duties have to be performed, I think your argument would, have a lot of merit, but I don't see, all we can do is interpret the statute as the legislature has proposed.
But why do you look at the White Bear Lake job description when you're determining that's the duty she performed? Why don't you look at the Hugo position? That's the position she was actually performing them for. I mean, you could look at, like I said, you could look at job descriptions from any city in the state, and they're covered by the plan. So does she qualify for the disability?
It talks about performing the normal duties of the position held by a person who is a member of the public employees, police, and fire retirement plan. She's a member of the White Bear Lake para plan, correct?
She is a member of the para plan, yes.
Okay. And she incurred injuries that arose out of the performance of inherently dangerous duties.
Correct. But not in a position.
And those inherently dangerous duties.
But not in a position covered by the plan.
That's not language that is there. It talks about the performance of inherently dangerous duties that are specific to the positions covered by the plan. It refers twice to the plan. And she's covered by the White Bear Lake plan.
But she's not doing the specific duty. It specifically says to a position. So you have to identify what position you're talking about.
Can I ask a question on the plural? Can you address your argument to the second part of the statute, that are specific to the positions covered by the public employees and police retirement plan. I assume you would recognize your argument would be stronger if that were in the singular. If it were the position covered, then it would be clear it's about the individual's position as opposed to a broader category of position.
It might be, yeah. That's a good point, Your Honor. But I still think you have to tie it to a specific position. You can't look at this in the abstract and say she's doing duties that are in any, you know, any job description of any firefighter. You have to identify, I think you have to identify the employer. Who is she doing these jobs for? That's the position that's referenced in this statute. And a similar argument under 299A.465, we make the same argument. You have to look to the employer. The employer is responsible for the continuing insurance requirements. She was not employed at the time of that, at the time of that injury. So under either of those statutes, I think it's imperative that you look to the position and the job description that she, or the job duties she was doing, but who she was doing them for, because that's the position that you have to determine, is that position covered by the plan?
If it's now, you make a number of policy arguments. If we conclude that the statute is clear and unambiguous, we don't even get to the policy arguments, right?
I think they're still applicable. I think the absurdity of the result still plays into interpreting the statute. If the interpretation, even if you think it's plain and unambiguous, is absurd, it can't be the right result. And it would be absurd for every time a White Bear Lake employee goes to work for another department, every time a police officer does similar activities outside the scope of their employment, that the employer is going to be liable for their injuries in those types of activities. That's not the intent of the law.
Well, we have the unique situation here, though, that she was actually employed by two different fire departments that had a reciprocity agreement. And in fact, she had been notified by both fire departments to respond to this. So this seems like a particularly unique set of facts that I think you acknowledge, and I'm not aware of any other case law that has addressed this particular fact situation.
Para acknowledged this is the first case they've ever seen like this, but it has nothing to do with the reciprocal services agreement. They indicated that, and the ALJ indicated that. During the testimony of Ms. Cortez, she said the reciprocal agreement had nothing to do with it.
Nothing to do with the decision.
Pardon me?
Well, when you say nothing to do with it.
Right, nothing to do with the decision to find a duty disability. In other words, the reciprocal agreement really doesn't come into play. She's responding to a Hugo fire in Hugo as a Hugo firefighter. Whether White Bear Lake shows up or not has nothing to do with it.
And that's what I want to go to, because it seems like the policy issue here cuts both ways, because she was notified by both Hugo and White Bear Lake to respond. She could have responded either as a Hugo firefighter or she could have responded as a White Bear Lake firefighter, right? Now, if we were to adopt your interpretation of the statute, wouldn't that disincentivize firefighters to ever go under a different, respond under a
respond to the volunteer fire department versus the White Bear.
Right. Wouldn't the firefighters say, well, you know, I realize that I've got a contract with them, but
at least they would have knowledge. They would have knowledge of this. If we make this the law as I interpret it, they'd have knowledge of that. It would not de-incentivize.
Why would they? I just want to finish my thought.
Yeah.
Why would they ever want to respond as a volunteer if they are injured and they're covered by their full-time employer? Wouldn't it disincentivize them to ever want to respond as a volunteer and say, you know what, with all due respect to that, I'm going to respond in my White Bear Lake capacity because I know I'll be covered. I won't, under, if we rule in your favor, they would not want to ever respond in a volunteer capacity, would they?
Number one, they have unique benefits for a volunteer firefighter that they clearly want. It provides a pension to them, and they want to respond and get their calls up to what's required for the local department. Number two, that does not mean they're excluded from any benefits from para. She would qualify for a regular disability. I mean, she's covered by the plan, but she gets a regular disability because if you read the verbiage for regular disability, it specifically talks about whether you're working.
But it doesn't cover working for the regular duties don't cover inherently dangerous activities, though.
So it's broader. It covers if you're injured.
But not for inherently dangerous. That's where the...
She'd be covered in this. She'd get a regular... She was initially granted a regular disability. She would qualify as a regular disability.
And your position is she was not at work for the city of White Bear Lake.
Absolutely not.
That's why regular disability is the one.
And that was the initial interpretation by a well-seasoned claims coordinator who looked at the plain language of the statute, which is what we're all supposed to do. She had the experience. She didn't have legal experience, but she had common sense experience and made that determination. We'd ask that we reverse the ALJ's determination.
Thank you, Counsel. And you have 5 minutes for rebuttal as well.
Yeah, thank you.
Counsel for respondent, you have 15 minutes. Please state your name for the record and the party you are representing.
May it please the court. My name is Lindsay Rowland, and I represent the respondent, Amy Kriegshauser. The purpose of the healthcare continuation statute is to provide firefighters who sustain career-ending injuries while firefighting with access to health insurance coverage. Ms. Kriegshauser sustained a career-ending injury while performing the duties of a White Bear Lake firefighter alongside a team of White Bear Lake firefighters under the command and control of the White Bear Lake Fire Chief.
Was she working as a White Bear Lake firefighter at the time of this fire?
Yes, Your Honor.
She was. Was she on the clock? I mean, was it a reg? I'm not sure how she's being paid, but the fact that she's available to take a volunteer call suggests to me that she wasn't on duty for White Bear Lake at the time. Am I wrong about that?
Ms. Kriegshauser's position is that she was working for both Hugo and White Bear Lake concurrently at the time she was injured. Minnesota courts have long held that an employee can work concurrently for multiple employers and that multiple employers can be held liable for events that occur during work events.
What's the strongest case you would have to suggest that in this context, where she's declined a call from White Bear, accepted a call from Hugo, that we would find as a matter of fact that she's concurrently employed?
The best argument is to look at the plain language of the statute. The plain language of a duty disability states that a member is eligible for a duty disability if she is injured performing the duties specific to the positions covered by the para, police, and fire plan.
I'd like to explore that with you, but first, I'm not sure that gets to Judge Bjorkman's question, which is who she's working for. The statute doesn't speak to that. Can you address that factual concern in this case, where it seems like the facts actually counter the position that you're taking, which is that she's working for White Bear Lake at the same time that she's working for Hugo?
Yes, Your Honor. Specifically, what I would point to is the fact that you don't have to be wearing a particular employer's uniform or be on the clock for that particular employer in order for an entity to be your employer. There are many other factors that come into play, including who is in the command and control of your actions, who you are performing your actions for, and many other factors which the judge considered as part of his ruling. The argument is that she was working for both Hugo and White Bear Lake at the time she was injured. She was working for both concurrently. But regardless, the statute doesn't...
That's the argument or the finding?
It is both the argument and the finding. So specifically looking at the ALJ's findings and order and conclusions of law... law. In his memorandum on page 11, the ALJ says, in addition, the fact that respondent was acting under the supervision of petitioner's fire chief when she was injured supports the conclusion that petitioner was respondent's employer for purposes of Minnesota statute section 299A.465. It is our position that the employer at the time of injury does not control because the plain language of the definition of a duty disability is not ambiguous. And according to its plain meaning, you look to the duties, not who the employer
but
was.
Those are two different arguments. I'm not, you kind of jumped from one argument to the other. I want to be clear. So, and I do want to talk about that statutory argument, but the fact that she's acting under the supervision of a supervisor, but not being paid at the time by that employer. How is it that she's within her employment if she's not being paid by that employer?
Because there are multiple doctrines recognized by the Minnesota courts that say that that issue of who's paying for the employee's work is not dispositive. So, for example, under the common enterprise doctrine and the lone servant doctrine and the dual purposes doctrine, an employee can be working for multiple employers at the same time.
But the ALJ didn't reject those arguments and didn't even analyze those. So the ALJ didn't rely on those, correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. The ALJ did not reject those arguments, but he did not rely on them. He concluded that based on the plain language of the statute, he did not need to look to those doctrines to decide this case. And I would like to address Judge Ross's question about whether we should be looking to the plain language of the statute or whether we should be looking at the employer at the time of injury. It's Ms. Kriegshauser's position that we should first look to the language of the statute, and the language of the statute is clear. But in the alternative, if this court decides that the employer at the time of injury is relevant or that it even controls, then the facts show that she was employed by both Hugo and White Bear Lake at the same time, and Ms. Kriegshauser should still prevail.
Well, let's talk about then the application of the statute as you interpret it, irrespective of the possibility of dual employment at the time of the injury. Is it confined to the state of Minnesota? The duties, the injury, does it have to occur in Minnesota? Assume she's on vacation in Hawaii and the hotel catches on fire and she starts to engage in duties of a firefighter and the White Bear Lake has no idea about the fire. I gather by your interpretation of the statute, because she's performing the duties that are consistent with her duties as a firefighter, that would be a covered event.
Your Honor, it's our position that it would be a factual determination and the judge would have to look at all of the facts.
So let's assume the facts I've just provided. Let's assume the facts are exactly as I've described them. Under your interpretation of the statute, I gather she would be covered.
Arguably, she would be.
Let's assume she's in, she's visiting family in the Ukraine, the Russian bomb hits, and the building catches on fire. Still covered.
Your Honor, I think one statute that may be helpful to the exploration of this hypothetical is Minnesota Statutes Section 299N.03. Under Subdivision 5, it defines full-time firefighter as, quote, a person who is employed and charged with the prevention or suppression of fires within the boundaries of the state. And so I think based on that, in your hypotheticals, she may not be, in fact, covered.
So Hawaii's out.
Hawaii's out.
Morehead
is
and
out.
Monona, still covered.
Yes, Your Honor. And I think that makes sense.
Can I ask you about the how do you interpret the phrase, positions covered by the public employees, police, and fire retirement plan? What does that mean?
Well, it's important to consider what are the positions covered by the Parapolice and Fire Plan. Those positions include police officers, firefighters, paramedics from various cities and counties throughout the state. And so it's our position that positions means firefighters, and that's what both para and—
Not tied to a particular employer, just anybody who works for anybody as a firefighter would meet that positions covered requirement?
Yes, Your Honor. Anyone who works as a firefighter who is covered by the Parapolice and Fire Plan. Full-time firefighters, which Ms. Kriegshauser was, are covered by the Parapolice and Fire Plan. I do want to address the issue that opposing counsel raised regarding the fact that Ms. Kriegshauser was also working as a volunteer firefighter. It's important to note that volunteer firefighters are not disqualified from receiving para-duty disability benefits. In fact, Chapter 353 specifically allows full-time firefighters covered by para to work concurrently as volunteer firefighters and maintain eligibility for para-duty disability benefits. So the fact that she was both a full-time firefighter for White Bear Lake, a position covered by the Parapolice and Fire Plan, and a part-time paid-on-call firefighter for Hugo is not dispositive.
So, meaning she doesn't lose her status as a holding a covered position just because she also has a non-covered position?
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay.
I also want to address Your Honor's questions about the public policy and legislative intent. I think it is important to note that when the language of the statute is clear, which it is here, then we don't look to public policy. But regardless, this is exactly what the legislature had intended. We can look to the legislative intent, which is codified in Minnesota Statute Section 353.66. That statute states that it is recognized policy of the state that special consideration should be given to the employees of governmental subdivisions who devote their time and skills to protecting the property and personal safety of others. Since this work is hazardous, special provisions are hereby made for retirement pensions, disability benefits, and survivors' benefits based on the particular dangers inherent in these occupations. The legislature recognizes that the occupation of a firefighter is inherently dangerous and warrants special consideration, including the provision of continued health insurance coverage.
Well, is that really a policy, or is that something that's already baked into the statute?
Your Honor, I would argue that it is a policy. So under Minnesota Statute Section 353.63, the title of that statute says policy. That is the policy of the legislature. That is why this health care continuation coverage is available for firefighters who are members of the Parapolice and Fire Plan.
Well, what about the policy of, isn't this really, if we were to accept your interpretation of the statute, the statutes, wouldn't that disincentivize the firefighter and police departments, particularly the smaller ones in greater Minnesota?
No, Your Honor, I don't think that it would. And
well, I think the amicus brief in particular, League of Minnesota Cities, would strongly disagree with your position there. And they work with the cities across the entire state.
Yes, Your Honor, but it's also important to point out that on page 11 of its amicus brief, the League of Minnesota Cities references that it specifically advises its members to contract out of the risk of being held liable for workers' compensation benefits or civil liability benefits because it knows that members who enter into reciprocal aid agreements, like the agreement between Hugo and White Bear Lake, that both employers could be held liable for the same work-related events. And so I would argue, and it is our position, that that the cities and counties who employ full-time firefighters and police officers, that they would seek to contract out of the risk and shift liability to one employer or the other. That is the way that they've addressed this exact scenario in other areas of law, and this area of law is no different. To your Honor's earlier point, you know, looking on the flip side, the public policy argument also cuts the other way. I think that it's very important to note that a full-time firefighter, if your honors accept the position of White Bear Lake, a full-time firefighter would be disincentivized to volunteer as a firefighter in their community. The idea that they gain pecuniary benefits or otherwise from volunteer firefighting, frankly, is ridiculous. Ms. Kriegshauser, in this case, was paid $16 per hour. She doesn't get a pension from the volunteer fire department. She was doing those duties in service to her community. The fact that the public policy as codified in the statute says that this benefit exists because the legislature recognizes the dangers that firefighters and others put themselves through is reason enough to award these benefits.
Counsel, you would agree, though, that if we conclude that the statutory language is clear and ambiguous, we don't even get to legislative intent, correct?
Correct, Your Honor.
But we have two positions that have said this is the plain language interpretation and another side saying this is a plain language interpretation. What if we were to conclude that both interpretations are reasonable? Wouldn't that lead to ambiguity then?
No, Your Honor. It's our position that the language of the statute is not ambiguous. Positions means the positions of a firefighter. That's the position of PARA and the position of the ALJ. And because the statute is not ambiguous, this court should affirm. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Counsel for appellant, you will have 5 minutes for rebuttal.
I'd like to address first the concurrent employer argument that was raised by respondent's counsel. That issue was never adopted by PARA or the ALJ. Those doctrines as cited by counsel are not applicable, don't apply, and is our position that the overwhelming facts are clear that she was employed by the city of Hugo. And the fact that the ALJ references that she was getting orders from the White Bear Lake chief is as impacting his decision that White Bear Lake was the employer is not only contrary to the statute, but not supported by the facts. She responded to Hugo. She was paid by Hugo. She received workers' compensation from Hugo. She affirmed her employment by seeking those employment workers' compensation.
As a practical matter, when you're on the scene, somebody is in charge.
And there's testimony in the record, Your Honor, that the incident commander, the Hugo chief, is the ultimate commander. And there is testimony that his decision to put this firefighter in the basement was his decision with the chief from the White Bear Lake concurring. So he was the ultimate commander and made the decision for her to go down into the basement where she got injured.
All right.
And just, can I?
Oh, yes, go ahead.
As pointed out by the League of Cities, if the employer changes depending on who's giving orders at a fire scene, that's a slippery slope. I mean, that can't be practical. It makes no sense whatsoever. She was employed by the city of Hugo. I think that should be.
And is it because she was being paid, had accepted the call and was being paid by them? And is that why we should conclude that Hugo was the sole employer?
Correct, yeah. I don't think there's evidence, and I don't think it's even argued in the briefs that they were legally concurrent employers. You can say they were concurrent employers, but if you're going to apply those doctrines, which were not done in the appellate briefs, that can't be something that this court can recognize at this point.
Would you agree that she could have responded in her capacity as a White Bear Lake firefighter?
Correct.
Okay.
And as I point out in my brief, if she had done that, she would not have gone to the fire. She would have gone to the fire station, because what happens when there's a call from a different city, the people on duty from the White Bear Lake stations go to the fire, and anyone else who is paged goes to the station to cover other fires within the city. So she would not even have been at the fire in Hugo. Just a factual point.
Does that make a difference to your argument about
no,
who the employee
was? No, I'm just pointing out that logistically that's how it would have gone down. I do want to identify this distinction between volunteer firefighters and full-time. There's clearly a distinction in the statute. And if you look at the statute specifically, I do not agree with counsel's interpretation that there's an exception that if they are employed by a para employer, that they are not exempt. That's not how I read the statute under 35301 2B14. Volunteer firefighters are clearly excluded from the from para generally, but the purpose of this statute, the way it's written, is that simply because you're a volunteer firefighter does not exclude you from everything available under para. There still are a para employee, but you have to apply the statute. And what I mean by that is she was not working for the City of White Bear Lake at the time, and I think we've established that. So as a result, she has a regular disability, not a duty disability.
But that argument hinges on the requirement under the statute that the employer be identified, correct?
Correct.
Okay.
And the reason I say that, again, I don't want to repeat myself, but under both duty disability and regular disability, it talks about, number one, the position, and under regular disability, whether they're working. Well, working means you're working for the employer of the para employer. So that's the distinction.
And where is that language in this either statute?
Under regular disability, it's 353.01, subdivision 46. And again, that was the initial determination. And
right, but she changed that determination. Para did.
Para changed that determination. We disagree with that based on the arguments we've articulated in the briefs. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your briefs and arguments. Both were very well done. We appreciate that. We will be issuing an opinion within the 90-day statutory time frame. Thank you both. And it was good seeing both of you in person as well.